For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, Governor Fallon kicked off the 2015 legislative session with her fifth State of the State address. Neva, what did you think of the speech?
Well, I think it is most State of the State. It's I think as we said about the inaugural, it's a rehash of accomplishments. It's setting some goals, and I think very lofty goals for what she wants to focus on in this term in her administration. There were a lot of facts, a lot of statistics, a lot of information. I'm not sure there was a lot of specifics on how to get there, and I think that leaves it wide open for, of course, the legislature to have a rough and tumble session trying to deal with some of these big issues. But they are issues that are on the table and do need to be addressed. So I think I'm still in that wait and see mode of where the rubber is going to hit the road on this deal.
Ryan, same question. What did you think?
I'm waiting on Governor Fallon to spend some of her political capital. She's one of the most successful politicians in Oklahoma history. She's won just about every election that she's been in, if not every election. She's been in politics for over three decades at this point. You know, where is the specificity? I mean, she's in a position where if she put out a very particular agenda, she has the political capital to drive it. You know, in law school exams, you get credit for spotting legal issues in a problem. And on that basis, the governor did a great job in her State of the State. Education, criminal justice reform, tax incentives, health care. But then her resolutions to those issues were all underwhelming. The criminal justice portion of her speech was very scripted. We cannot drug court our way out of this corrections crisis. And unless we get sentencing reform on the table, everything else is really just a charade. And I think that, you know, there are multiple criminal justice proposals that she could have incorporated into her speech that are on the table this legislative session, and she didn't do that. And I think that we're, again, you know, with tax incentives even, you know, she wants to bring the Pew Trust in to come in and study the issue. I mean, how many times do we need to bring in an outside group to tell us what we're doing wrong? Maybe we just need to get into the position of outsourcing the entire legislature.
And I thought it was also interesting that she threw a few bills, just kind of laced them in there, like the texting mm-hmm. while driving. You know, that's a bill that was kind of DOA last session, didn't go anywhere. Senator Ron Sharp's got a bill, and I think there are a couple of other versions mm-hmm. that are out there. It'll be interesting talking about political capital. Is that something that you feel passionate enough that when the kind of the counter argument is going to be, I think, that there are already laws on the books like inattentive of driving and other things that they'll hang their hat on that the opponents of this type of legislation. So again, if you throw them out there, do you really want to follow through? And is that something you're going to expend some political capital on? Because clearly there's a lot of sentiment, I think, among the public on some issues like this where you could get some traction.
Maybe the biggest news is what she didn't talk about. And the one word that she didn't mention the entire speech, and if she did, I missed it, Obama. I don't know that there's been a State of the State where since she's been governor that she hasn't gone after the federal government, in particular the Obama administration.
I think that's true. She did allude to the fact that she wanted to make efforts with the federal government on Ensure Oklahoma to try to still make that a reality
and
continue that.
But it wasn't so much an attack.
But it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't the strident partisanship that we've seen in the past.
Well, now talking about that, the executive budget also came out with a $300 million shortfall. Most agencies are getting flat appropriations or cuts, but she did suggest increases in education, Department of Human Services, and health care. Ryan, what do you think of this budget?
You know, the Oklahoma Policy Institute has a really good blog piece that analyzes their four big takeaways from the executive budget. And even in those areas where you do have funding increases, those funding increases fall well short of where the agencies need to be able to perform just not even extra state services, but critical baseline state services. The education budget comes in enough to pay for essentially the increased cost of health benefits for teachers and support staff. There's nowhere near the money on the table that you need to do anything like a state-based pay increase for teachers.
Right, and Eva, what'd you
say? Well, you know, one of the things that Governor Fallon said in the State of the State was that the state last year collected the most ever in total revenue, $13.6 billion, I believe it was the figure. And I think it's where we are is there going to be the political will and courage to really get down into the weeds of these budgets and address where strategic cuts need to be made and not just continue to throw money at the big ticket items that we know clearly need money, education and these areas where there are legitimate needs for some increased funding, but you can't have that at the expense of just, let's take the easy way out and just have across-the-board cuts and then not really fix any of the systemic problems that we've got with these budgets. So I think it's time for the lawmakers to really roll up their sleeves and really spend some time on this. And it really lends, I think, to the argument that maybe its time has come that they spend every other year really addressing budgeting as opposed to just throwing 2,000 bills out on the floor and letting them somehow go through the process.
And maybe zero-based budgeting, which a lot of Representative Dorman had talked about doing something like that.
Well, and you know, I think that it's important to look at the historical perspective of this as well. You know, a lot of these agencies that are taking cuts or that are receiving less than they're being suggested in the executive budget, they've taken huge hits over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And some of these agencies are nearly 30% off of where they were in 2008.
And some of these agencies have revolving funds with millions of dollars sitting there that they don't want anyone to get a hold of, and they want to make sure that they continue to ask for more. At the same time, there's money clearly stuck in crevices all throughout these state budgets that I think if we would really get down to the heart of the matter, there's a lot more money there than anyone wants to own up to.
If that money is in the revolving funds and it's lawfully able to be used. I mean, we saw the Attorney General slap down the executive branch and the legislature for trying to use some of that money. It's not the agency's decision in many of these instances of how they spend the money.
But not in all instances,
and
I think.
So, but even if we did tap into that, you know, the governor's looking at $300 million and transferring in from these revolving funds. That's a one-time fix. That doesn't get us, you know, 5, 10 years out from where we need to be on state services.
No, but I think it is a start. And I think to just set that aside and not be bold and really move that direction continues to kind of keep us in this ongoing dialogue that really goes nowhere.
The legislative session got started with two high-profile bills getting killed before even getting a hearing. The so-called Hoodie Bill, which garnered national attention, was declared dead on arrival by Judiciary Chairman Anthony Sykes, who says Senate Bill 13 would be a distraction. Neva, do you agree with the decision to not even hear this bill?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, they can't possibly hear every bill. That's nothing new. It's a situation where you've got a lot of bills like this, got a lot of attention, unnecessarily so, I think, a lot of national attention that, frankly, there were a lot of other issues that I think I would like to have read the headlines or heard about rather than this one. So, you know, I'm glad that they're dispatching some of these bills quickly. Not everything can go through the process, you know, we'll see what happens from here on.
Ryan, were you surprised by this?
I don't think it was either going to come up for a vote so that everybody would have had an opportunity to vote against it, or it was going to be done away with in this manner. And you know, I think that you know what we've got now is a template, and you know it's this idea that if something is a bad bill, if it's a solution in search of a problem, you know, rather than giving it legitimacy by granting it a legislative hearing, then you just do away with it, but by not hearing it at all. I wish that we followed that model in many other instances.
Late last week, Representative Sally Kern announced she was pulling her bill, which allowed businesses to discriminate against homosexuals. Ryan, were you surprised by that?
I was surprised that she withdrew the bill. You know, and I think that it's an early victory for LGBT equality in the Oklahoma legislative session. You know, that said, there are any number of legislative vehicles out there that would legalize discrimination against LGBT Oklahomans. You know, we saw and that I think confuse many issues. That are already well settled. You know, we saw legislation this year or this last week pass out of committee to protect clergy who don't want to perform gay marriages. Well, if you don't want to perform a same-sex marriage, you don't have to. Just like if you're a rabbi and somebody that's Catholic comes to you and wants to be married, you don't have to marry them. You know, that's well-established First Amendment law. Yet here we've legitimized this concern that's really a concern without any foundation. And, you know, finally, I think that it's important that our leaders from the very top, Governor Fallon, they need to speak out early and often on these bills because, you know, she's got some political capital leadership. And in response, you know, her response was just pretty lame. She said she doesn't have any comment on this bill, but she says, and I quote, "I have gone to restaurants with gay friends." You know, that's not the kind of leadership that we need.
Neva.
Well, I'm glad to see that that this one is off the table quickly. I think her comment was that that the bill as she introduced it didn't really accomplish her desired purpose, whatever that, you know, however she wants to expand upon that. But again, I think let's get past some of these sensational bills that get a lot of attention that we know are not going to go anywhere, that will not have the support within the total legislature to make it to the governor's desk, and let's get down to the ones that really do matter.
And very quickly, a question from one of our listeners via Twitter, at the Digsy, asks, can Kern actually withdraw House Bill 1597 since it's already filed and referred to rules?
Sure. I mean, you can. I mean, Ryan was a legislator. He can probably speak more eloquently than I can on that. But, I mean, there's give and take on bills once they get in the process. And certainly you don't. You can even have a bill go to committee and decide you want to have the bill withdrawn and not heard.
So it's pretty much up to the author.
Yeah, it's up to the author. Technically, I don't know that the bill goes away. I mean, I think the bill remains as an introduced measure in this legislative session. But the author generally has control over their bill. So if they don't want it on an agenda, whether it's in a committee or on the floor, usually leadership respects that. I mean, I think that there has to be an extraordinary circumstance for them to override the will of the
author. And at that point,
there
may well be another author that takes it, right, or something else.
Or it could be a shell bill. They could take the title, yeah, and the information, right, out and make something else. Now, finally, the Tulsa School Board picked a new superintendent, former Rhode Island Education Commissioner Deborah Gist. Neva, what do you think about the board's decision?
Well, I mean, when you read about her, I mean, it's a pretty phenomenal pick, I think. I have to applaud the school board. It was unanimous. I think not only is this someone who is a product of the Tulsa Public Schools, but she has really an extraordinary career in education. She was a classroom teacher for 8 years, teacher of the year in both districts she was in, went on to be involved in the District of Columbia, heading up education there, Rhode Island, for the last 8 years. She not only has undergraduate and graduate and doctorate, but she also has a master's from the JFK School of Government at Harvard. I mean, a very impressive person. I think she was Time Magazine several years ago named her one of the 100 most influential people in the country, and she is certainly someone that when you look at her record in education and her accomplishments, I think Tulsa is the big winner now in public education with her coming on as superintendent.
She certainly comes with a little bit of controversy. Ryan, do you think this is a good decision for Tulsa?
Yeah, I think that whether or not Dr. Gist proves out to be the best decision, you know, that's still up to her, right? Mm-hmm. And I think she certainly has the accolades and the background that would lead us to believe that she could very well do an outstanding job in this position. She's had congratulations from people on the right, people on the left, but I think that the process in which Tulsa Public Schools went through to select a new superintendent has raised more questions than provided answers. You know, there was a very little lack of input from parents, from teachers, from the types of stakeholders that are normally at the table whenever you select a new superintendent. And as a result, you know, many of the news reports said that these groups were getting their information about Dr. Gist from Google searches. You know, they're going online trying to figure out what they could about her. One of the big concerning things that they found about her was that she was part of this national organization that also was an organization that Janet Barisi was a part of. And you know, they were concerned that would inform Dr. Gist's leadership style in Tulsa Public Schools. I think a lot of that remains to be seen. There's this wide gulf between what people have learned about her online and what the Tulsa Public School Board consider whenever they made their decision.
Well, and the school board members themselves said that they had exhaustive interviews with people that had been involved with her across her career. And I think one of the things when you look at in many of the places where she's been, the innovative models and literacy programs and other things that she's gotten national acclaim for, she also has a reputation for someone who really wants to empower teachers to be part of the public policy process, and she has a track record to prove that. So I would think educators right down there in the classroom would react very favorably to that, as well as programs that really heightened cooperation and participation with parents and community leaders and other stakeholders, as you say, Ryan. So I think, to try to taint it with some version of, she was in some group and all of these other sinister characters in the minds of some educators were involved is really unnecessary. And I think, again, I on the surface, everything indicates that this is a superior decision on the part of the school board.
And I think that there's going to be this interim period between her and retiring Superintendent Ballard where, hopefully a lot of those, if they indeed are myths about her leadership style, that she's got this opportunity to dispel them before she actually takes over the reins.
And I think that's wise. I think
Dr. Ballard's probably going to work very closely.
And I think this week out in the classrooms and starting to meet folks, and I think the fact that his retirement is not until June 30th affords them an opportunity to be able to have that period where they can kind of melt some of this stuff together and make sure that there is a smooth transition.
Right. Smart move.
Yeah. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.